So this paper is about how, at the beginning of the 20th century, photography could be represented as a vehicle of knowledge about animal emotions. In his famous essay, Why Look at Animals?, John Berger presented wildlife photographs as the culmination of a modern worldview that emptied animals of subjectivity. This view, Berger argued, was rooted in René Descartes' dualist ontology, which reduced animals to machines. Deprived of the capacity for inner experience, animals appeared mere collections of unvarying actions, their behaviour entirely predictable. This logic was often instrumental to defences of vivisection in the late 19th century, which condemned sympathetic depictions of animal suffering as delusive anthropomorphism, and that was really the first time that anthropomorphism was used in the sense of talking about animals rather than talking about God, as it had previously been used. Paul White notes that a new class of professional experimental zoologists in university laboratories thus framed the human-like appearance of many animals' responses as illusions. Figures such as Claude Bernard argued that such apparent emotions were produced by humans projecting their own emotional natures onto other beings. Such experimental zoology mechanized animal affectivity through the model of the reflex. Indeed, the American biologist Jacques Loeb went even further, comparing animals' responses to stimuli to the tropisms of plants, seemingly wholly automatic. Photography could play a role in this discourse. Its perceived objectivity seemed to offer a means of recording animals' features and movements without the distorting influence of human judgment, feeling, or taste. In the last decades of the 19th century, Edward Muybridge and Etienne Jules Marie used innovative forms of rapid photography to capture details of animal movement, normally imperceptible to human sight. Anne Shelby Blum has shown that through the 19th century, zoological illustration gradually transitioned from predominantly pictorial representations towards more schematic images that prioritised accuracy of individual details over general aesthetics. Muybridge and Marie's photographs resemble extensions of this process. The workings of animal machines seem to be perfectly revealed by the machine of the camera. However, Eileen Christ has observed that the machine metaphor or mechanomorphism that underlay this culture of laboratory zoology was just as unproven and questionable as the anthropomorphism that it rejected. The insistence on animals' mechanicism was animated less by the discovery of definitive new data than by the authority associated with mathematical precision and experimental control, exemplified in more prestigious, institutionally established sciences such as chemistry and physics. By approaching animals as machines of fixed qualities and predictable responses, laboratory zoologists could claim to achieve a similar precision and control. It is therefore apt that one of the most powerful voices against animal mechanomorphism in the period was Charles Darwin, whose studies of animal behaviour relied on anecdotes and observations in the field rather than laboratory experiments. In his 1872 book, The Expression of the Emotions in Man and Animals, Darwin argued that humans and animals' shared evolutionary history had produced a broad range of shared basic emotions, which could be studied through a combination of empirical testing and sympathetic looking. Photography formed a key part of Darwin's evidence, but the photographic plates included in his book were limited to humans. While Darwin had employed the expert Oscar Rejlander to photograph various emotional expressions in human subjects, Darwin relied on drawings to illustrate animals' comparative emotions. This shortcoming was dictated by the form's technical limitations at the time. Philip Prodger notes that even Rejlander's photographs of humans that seemed to capture authentic emotions in the moment were in fact heavily posed due to the long exposure times and stillness required. Contemporary photographs of animals were even more posed, typically consisting of dead specimens frozen in position. Cameras' exposure times, magnification, and fields of vision rapidly improved, however, while they became increasingly smaller and more portable, leading to photographs such as Ottomar Anschütz's images of birds in flight, which were first unveiled in Germany in 1884. So the scene was changing very quickly. In his recent History of Bird Conservation, Stefan Bargier argues that the development of the camera and binoculars towards the turn of the century as tools of the field ornithologist energized a new discourse of sentimental appreciation of living birds in the wild and revulsion at the hunting of them. Magnifying and photographing living animals, Barkier suggests, encouraged naturalists to value them as living beings rather than just as potential specimens in a cabinet. Such sentimentalism resonated with a broad movement in popular natural history writing at the turn of the century towards the sympathetic study of wild animals. For example, Eliza Brightwen's book, Wild Nature Won by Kindness, described the emotive relationships that the author developed with creatures by nursing them back to health after finding them injured around her, the estate where she lived. Similarly, Ernest Thompson Seton's Wild Animals I Have Known offered anthropomorphic, highly sentimental narratives of woodland creatures, supposedly based on the author's observations. The latter book would be a key text in the so-called Nature Fakers controversy, when the American naturalist John Burroughs attacked authors such as Seton for prioritizing imagination and fanciful desire over empirical evidence and sober scientific skepticism. I suggest that new light can be shed on this clash of mechanomorphic zoology with sympathetic popular natural history and the complex role of photography in it through an examination of a strange and unclassifiable book published by the naturalist author Douglas English in 1903. We Timorous Beasties, Studies of Animal Life and Character, combined photographs of live wild animals, either moving or at rest, with anthropomorphic narratives that imagined the inner experiences of the creatures depicted. The title alludes to Robert Burns's poem, To a Mouse, in which the speaker apologizes to a frightened mouse whose nest has been exposed by a human plough. The situations of English's animal protagonists were not simply fictions, however, or at least not all of them. Some were based on English's interactions with the animals photographed, such as catching them in traps, and all drew on his extensive observations of wild animals and visual documentation of their behaviours. Excuse me. English was the first president of the London-based Zoological Photographic Club, which was founded in 1899, and he would become the editor of the periodical Wildlife, founded in 1913, which showcased wildlife photography. 2 years before We Timorous Beasties, he published Photography for Naturalists, a dry instruction manual for tyros in the field. Yet, although English was a respected naturalist who presented his wildlife photography as a vehicle of science, he also regarded it as a somewhat creative practice. In an editorial for Wildlife, he rejected the idea that wildlife photographs must retain all of the defects of the negatives for the sake of objectivity. We are of opinion, English wrote, that the aim of the nature photographer should be to secure a positive record, not only as truthful as his ability can make it, but also as pleasing as his ability can make it. The ability to mitigate or correct artistic defects implies an artistic instinct, or at least an artistic training. In their book Objectivity, Lorraine Daston and Peter Gallison contend that at the turn of the 20th century, the ideal of objective observation increasingly caused science and the arts to be conceptualized in opposition to each other. In this formulation, the scientist worked by self-conscious method, while the artist worked by intuition and tact, his knowledge subsisting more in mysterious feeling than logical inference. However, this opposition is more recognisable among the aforementioned professionalising laboratory zoologists than in natural history in general, which involved many different kinds of observers and modes of representation. Natural history writing for non-specialist audiences was yet to be fully differentiated from nature writing, a genre of prose in which authors combined factual knowledge of the natural world with their aesthetic, emotional reactions to it and personal memoir. Think of Helen MacDonald's H is for Hawk, that was very popular a few years ago. Further, professionalisation was generally limited to museums and laboratories, while field studies remained in the hands of amateurs who felt less pressure to rein in their emotional and aesthetic sensibilities. Such investigators could look to older romantic models of the naturalist, such as Alexander von Humboldt, who had stressed his intuitive sympathy with nature. Similarly, I suggest that English's vision of the wildlife photographer as a hybrid of scientist and artist enabled him to portray the creatures he photographed as sympathetic subjects whose inner affective experiences could be imagined by the sensitive observer. The text of We Timorous Beasties anchors this sympathetic reading of the images, suggesting that the camera has captured emotional moments in the animals' lives, which imaginative narrative can decipher. So the book, which reproduces over 150 images of wild animals, begins with the story of a vole caught in a non-lethal trap, depicted in a photograph. English's narration defamiliarises this object by describing it from the vole's point of view. Of the vole, we are told, in front of him were three horizontal wires, above him were nine more, on either side an upright wooden wall, behind him a slanting one, whose lower extremity nipped his tail. On the floor lay innumerable crumbs of evil-smelling cheese. When the door of the trap had clicked behind him, he'd naturally been startled. His fright, however, was due not so much to his surroundings, he was used to close quarters, as to the forcible restriction of his tail. English's description reflects the vole's ignorance of human technology, registering the trap as a collection of baffling parts and shapes. The description moves seamlessly from external physical features to inner feelings, framing the vole's fear as an observable fact, albeit one ascertained through sympathetic imagination. English goes on to describe the vole's protracted efforts to squeeze through the bars of the trap until, quote, sick with weariness and mad with thirst, he lost his head. Then he flung himself recklessly in every direction, bruising his poor body against the unyielding bars, desperate, grimy, pitiable. And there's another image where the vole is sort of has its paws on the bars of the cage and is sort of staring out with these big eyes. Again, the narration blends objectively observable actions with inferred emotional states, interpreting the vole's movements as signs of a sick, mad, and desperate state of mind. English further implies that the observation of such emotions is inherently intersubjective, forming a bridge between the subject's emotional expressions and the observer's reactions to them. Hence, the vole's state is, quote, pitiable, inviting pathos from the naturalist viewer. English's narration guides readers' experiences of the images, encouraging them to see feelings in the photographs as well as physical bodies. As the narration recalls a time when the vole and one of his companions had narrowly escaped the jaws of a dog, English includes a photograph of two voles climbing out of a container of corn to hide behind it. The caption taken from the text reads, "A frantic scramble landed them over the edge of the bin." English's choice of words invites us to infer frenzied fear from the prickled hairs and large black eyes in the picture. Interestingly, English goes to great lengths to cultivate sympathy for such animals, only for them to die miserable deaths. The book contains two stories of voles, and while the first is killed by its human trapper, the second is mauled to death by another species of voles after blundering into their den. In this way, English figures the world of wild animals as a scene of tragedy consisting of heroic creatures that suffer painful ends due to cruel fate. As the second vole lies dying, the narrator reflects, was he not the intruder? And when was ever mercy accorded to such among four-footed things? Although the vole is doomed, he attains nobility by struggling bravely against it. We are told that despite realising immediately that he is no match for his attackers, the vole stuck grimly to his task and fights back, however futilely. English's book also identifies more positive emotions in its animal subjects. In the narrative of a dormouse awakening from winter hibernation, English portrays the impulse that propels the dormouse to leave its sleeping place as a relatable joie de vivre. We read that once more he felt the magic pulse of life within him and ran to the top of the hedge and down again 20 times for the mere joy of running. The passage recalls Carl Grues's The Play of Animals, published 4 years earlier, which had argued that pleasurable play was a key motivating force in the behaviour of all mammals. Replicating the passage in a photograph caption, English invites us to read pleasure and desire in the photographed dormouse's tensed muscles as it grips a branch. English further suggests that the creature's impulses are rooted in aesthetic pleasure at the beauty of spring, similar to that which humans enjoy and celebrate in art and poetry. The dormouse is delighted by, quote, the azure of the hyacinth, the rose blush of the almond, the crimson glow of the clover, the purple of the foxglove, as well as the tender modulation of the avian chorus and the deep-throated, innumerable, drowsy hum of insects. To tell of all he heard and saw that day would fill a book. Q Curiously here, English uses a photograph to illustrate the world from an animal's point of view, instead of making the animal simply the object of observation. So we have an image of an orange-tipped butterfly, which forms part of the medley of colours and shapes which announce the arrival of spring to the dormouse and spur his excitement. Yet, at the same time, English seems to open up a space for animal perception, only to turn the animal perceiver into a kind of cipher for human appreciators of nature. Positive emotions are also conveyed in a story of newts, accompanied by underwater photographs of them in action. The male protagonist encounters a female, and they engage in a mating ritual, the narrator commenting, "Probably it was a case of mutual attraction. He swung his tail and crest before her, comeliest and most debonair of all her suitors, and she, with an engaging smile, swung a responsive tail at him." The accompanying photograph records their tails in swishing motion, as though such animals' emotions of sexual attraction and desire are physical facts that can be captured on camera. Noting the female's relative lack of decoration compared to the male, the narrator concludes that her charm was in herself. This turn of phrase emphasises the intersubjective nature of attraction, involving a charm that exists simultaneously in the attractor and the eyes of the attractee. As creatures of sexual attraction, readers are encouraged to empathise with the newts, even though the latter's aquatic tail movements seem far removed from most human courtship behaviour. However, this elision of human and animal desire is problematized by English's own attention to detail. By acknowledging that the male newts are more decoratively clad than the females, his description points to Darwin's argument that sexual selection among such animals is centered around the female rather than the male gaze. English's narration contradicts this point, however, by centering upon the male protagonist and his desires, so as to replicate the patriarchal conventions of Edwardian human society. The reader is also encouraged to empathise with animals' amatory feelings in the story of a harvest mouse who finds a mate among the cornfields. Again, English offers photographs of an animal not just as visualisations of its emotions, but to put the reader in the position of another animal spectator, watching and reacting emotionally to that animal. The description of the female mouse aestheticises her visual form in order to convey the visceral effect of her presence on her female pursuer. Of the photographed mouse, we read, "Her front was of the purest white and twisted in a dainty curve to match her features. Her eyes were small, but they were very gentle." These features explain the male's long pursuit of her and struggle, and also his struggle with another rival male for her affection. Picturing the two males fighting on the top of the corn stalks as the sun descends, the narrator reflects, "Never was finer mise-en-scène for a conflict." In such moments, the theatrical register of English's storytelling shifts to melodrama as the lurid crimson ground, which is caused by the sunset, produces a pathetic fallacy to suit the mood of the scene. The implication is clear. In the bared teeth of the mice, readers should recognise the jealous anger of human duelling love rivals. So I've only had time here to offer a preliminary sketch of English's strange and in some ways contradictory book. As some of the examples cited have shown, the text vacillates between detailed observations of animals' species-typical behaviours and fanciful reveries on their possible thoughts, which can be anthropomorphic to a degree that seems to depart from any effort at scientific realism. Sometimes his animal characters actually speak, like the animal ciphers in a fairy tale or Rudyard Kipling's Jungle Book. Yet, however much English's text seems to wander from the tone and register of serious, authoritative science, its photographic images constantly remind the reader of the painstaking research and observation that lie behind it. At the same time, the interchange between English's narrative description and the pictures of real animals in various stances and movements echoes Darwin's earlier model of animal emotionality as a phenomenon that blended physical facts with imaginative sympathy. Such a hybrid phenomenon perhaps called for a hybrid form of representation, blending the sensibilities and styles of science and art. However, as my analysis has also suggested, the nature of English's implied interspecies fellow feeling was problematic. We heard this morning about empathy as an attempt to get into the other, to understand a being different to you. And it often feels as though the more that English claims to take us inside the animals he photographs, the more he downplays their alterity, turning them into mirrors of ourselves. So questions of what we mean by sympathy and empathy as alternative or perhaps, you know, concepts which blend into each other, I think are quite key here. So thank you.